Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Axiom of Choice and the Chaos of Paradise. Today, we'll spend most of the hour with Dr. Muzaffar Alamin, who was Iraq's ambassador to Berlin during 1990 and 1991, and to London from 1999 to just before the U.S. invaded his country. Dr. Amin elected to retire his ambassadorship rather than continue with the Bremer-led Coalition Provisional Authority. First, though, an acknowledgement of the 8th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. President and Mrs. Obama began the day of commemoration on the White House South Lawn, where 200 members of the White House staff joined them to observe a moment of silence at 8:46 a.m., the moment the first plane struck the North Tower of the World Trade Center. That was the day that also pretty much began what we've known since then as the Global War on Terror, with a retaliatory attack on Afghanistan in a war that continues today and that President Obama seems determined to escalate. Meanwhile, as a nation that seems able to focus only on one major event at a time, the ongoing destruction of Iraq, actually begun with the sanctions imposed during the 1990s, has fallen off the front pages of major media outlets in the United States. Actual numbers of Iraqi deaths due to war, defined as excess deaths, continue to be disputed and we'll probably never know with any certainty the number of dead due to sanctions and war, not because it's impossible to find out, because it's a tremendously hot political issue. Later in the show, we'll review some of the hot political issues involved by looking at the International Criminal Court and where it is headed 10 years after the signing of the Rome Statute that brought it into being. We'll spend most of our hour today with Dr. Muzaffar Alamin, whom I interviewed on September 11th. It is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Muzaffar Alamin, who has been the ambassador of Iraq to the UN during the 1980s, to Berlin, Germany during the early 1990s, and from 1999 to 2003, he was ambassador of Iraq and based in London. Dr. Muzaffar Alamin retired when the US invaded Iraq, refusing to work with the Green Zone government. Most recently, Dr. Alamin was general manager of the Middle East offices of an engineering firm based in Amman, Jordan. Welcome, Dr. Muzaffar Alamin.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you with us today. Now, let me give our listeners a little bit of your background. You received a BA and an MA in the US, so you know our culture to some degree.
Indeed.
And you received your PhD in modern Arabic history from Durham University in the UK.
Yes.
So you're speaking from an expertise, a multicultural expertise, which is what we like on our show. You've also researched, translated, written, and published extensively. In an article published in the UK Guardian in 2002, you wrote, "The US cannot make war on Iraq without British diplomatic cover." Let's begin by exploring that statement and reviewing a little of modern history. We'll start with Britain's relationship with Iraq during the Second World War and weave into that, if you can, a review of the British-American competition over Iraq during the same period.
Before the First World War, Iraq was under the occupation of the Ottoman Empire. It was part of the Turkish Ottoman Empire, which consisted of three governorate: Baghdad, governorate Mosul, and Basra. The British came, invaded Iraq in 1914, at the beginning of the First War. And they wanted to, they would liberate Iraq. They wanted to finish the British rule and, take the Middle East under their control from the Ottoman Empire. They had many problems in Iraq, fighting the Turkish army. Until 1918, they occupied Baghdad, and which actually in 1917 and in 1918 occupied all of Iraq. They came as liberator, and supposedly they would give Iraq the independence. But as a British rule, they declared Iraq under their mandate. So the Iraqis had a strong revolution in 1920. They call it the Iraqi Revolution of 1920, mainly in the south, against the British rule, and they were forced to make a government, a national government under King Faisal, who came from Mecca or Saudi Arabia now. And it was a national rule, but under the British mandate. Iraq gained independence, semi-independence, in 1932 and became member of the United Nations League, they called it at the time. And it was under a monarchy, which under the British influence. In 1958, there was a revolution in July 58 against the monarchy, a very bloody revolution, and the Republicans were led by the army. And from 58 until 68, Iraq was in a turmoil. In 1968, the Ba'ath Party took hold of the government, and till 1979, it was ruled by al-Bakr, who was an older military man. 79, Saddam Hussein took over. And at the same year, Khomeini was in power, came to power from in Iran, and started his, I would call, engaging Iraq in a verbal and political war and a religious war. And Saddam Hussein felt threatened by Khomeini, and he started the big attack against Iran, and we had 8 years war until 1988. A lot of people accuse Iraq of starting the war, but definitely there was many attacks by Khomeini regime against Iraq. And after 2 weeks of starting the war in September 1980, Iraq accepted a United Nations resolution to stop the war, but Iran refused, and until their army was really defeated and accepted the ceasefire in 1988. Actually, I was at the United Nations. Mm-hmm. By the way, I wasn't the ambassador of Iraq. I was the deputy ambassador.
Ah, okay.
Bless his soul, Mr. Ismet Kittani was the Iraqi ambassador, and he was a well-known international diplomat, and I was his assistant. And it is a historical moment was for me in 17th of July 1988, I received the letter from Iran accepting the ceasefire, which was given to me by de Quillar, the Secretary General of the United Nations.
Let's take a quick look at the state that Iraq was in after all of this war. What was going on socially there?
Well, before the war, from 79 and 70, Iraq had a social and educational revolution, really. There were a great strikes in hospitals, in medical sectors, in university, in housing, in salary, and in scholarships. Abroad to England, to France, to Russia, to the United States. We sent thousands and thousands of students, which created a huge bulk of scientists and social scientists. At the time when I was studying my PhD in 1975 to 1980, when I graduated from Durham, there were 6,000 Iraqi students on a scholarship studying in the United Kingdom. We had free hospitalization, free education all the way, university, even the books, even the dormitory. We had almost a free housing. We had the good economy supporting small industries, small factories. But sure, when the war started and it was very damaging, and it was a primitive war between the two countries, it did a lot of damage to Iran and to Iraq. And for a long, long time, 8 years, all the resources were emptied. Our GMP, we had $40 billion in saving. We wound up losing the whole money and borrowing a lot more from Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and even from Germany, where I was. The effect of war, we lost many, many young people. We had many others who survived, even that had turned to the army. And the women played a big role. The men were fighting, so the women actually run the government and run the houses. We had a witness of somehow liberated women going, shopping, buying, working in the offices, but it has a severe effect on the society and damaging on the city and institutions.
One of the effects I know from Iraqi women that were part of that system of working while the men were at war was that so many men, young men and men were killed that now there are fewer women that are able to have families, that will have families.
Well, yes. We had a lot of widows and the ratio of unmarried women was much higher than the usual in Iraq. Now, today, after the invasion of the aggression in 2003 against Iraq, we have 1 million widow. This is according to a report 6 months ago published by the United Nations. 1 million widow and 3 million orphans. About 700,000 older women that haven't been married, actually. Mm-hmm. So there is definitely the balance of the Iraqi society is incorrect, to say the least, mm-hmm. and that promoted many people and many women to immigrate, to go to Syria, to Jordan, to any opportunity outside Iraq, mm-hmm. because there is no jobs, no life, no electricity, no water. No.
And yet the impression that we are getting from the media here in the United States at this time is that things are picking up, that everything is getting better in Iraq, and that we, the Americans, don't have to worry so much about it because it's getting better.
Not at all. Actually, the aggression and the removing of the government, and they dismantled the society, the Iraqi society. There is a huge damage to every sector. I mean, the farmers, the industrials, everyone was hurt by this war that was based on lies. And actually, the life in Iraq is really unbearable, and that's why you see so many millions have left, not only politically, but even the social life and the economic life is so harsh and difficult, and the security is none, but the whole society is not balanced. Anybody who could have some money to leave the country left or aspire to leave. The remaining people there are struggling, and they have no choice but to stay. Mm-hmm. My own family, my own sisters, my brother family, they cannot leave because they have a big family, and then now they have grandchildren, they cannot leave by themselves, leave the others in Iraq. There is a great damage it needs years and years to recover the Iraqi society as it was before. We were basically an industrious society, really. And in the 70s and 80s, my wife did the research on sociology. More than 50% of the society, of the engineers, the doctors were women. More than 50% of the teachers were women. We arrived, and you could check it, in the early 80s, late 70s, illiteracy was almost 100%. We had no illiterate, even in the villages. So we formed a very good basic scientific. And without going out of your subject, I think basic, that what we think, and it could be, we always think of a conspiracy theory, that Iraq became such a strong society, economically, scientifically, it is threatening in the Middle East. It's not the political system, regardless of who's ruling and what.
Well, I wanted to ask you this when you were talking about what was happening in Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. So many resources had gone into that war that I was wondering if there is a, if you have a warning for us in the United States, who've now sunk so many resources into our wars, and we don't have a healthcare system for all of our people. We have a education system that really is tremendously expensive for everybody that gets involved in it. How does it look to you coming here to the United States?
Well, I tell you honestly, from my reading history, and I'm a historian, and I'm an Iraqi, and I'm an Arab, and I'm a Muslim, war through the history never achieved. There is not a winner in war. Both sides are losers. Mm-hmm. And you know, the peace movement, when I was here studying in the 60s and early 70s against Vietnam, I mean, it really made sense that this great country, the United States, is a great country with great people, really. They could have achieved a lot more by peaceful means and by contributing in many ways, in the training, in education, in even Peace Corps that was before, and a lot more than what they achieved in having wars against Vietnam, against Cambodia, against Korea, and the whole outcome is what you see in the Arlington National Cemetery and other cemeteries, are young, beautiful young people dying. Okay, you die for your country if you defend it, if there is an aggression. But to make an aggression, it's a crime by itself, and at the same time, you are even defending yourself, is you are getting hurt. So the notion of United Nations, which is weakened by the Bush administration, is a damage to the whole world. Mm-hmm. This one should be strengthened, that you could deal with it through the United Nations and having negotiations and settlement. But to come and wipe out a government or a people, it doesn't do any good. And then it creates another war. The war creates another war. This is exactly what happened in the First World War. It created the Second World War, that Germany felt, you know, the way they treated it was a treaty. So I call for peace, for understanding, for helping, extending a good hand to the other people, to look at what's happening in Africa with people dying because they cannot have a piece of bread.
What do you make of the fact that we do things this way here in this country, though? Because I think you're right, we do have a choice, and we choose to do the military option rather than the peace option.
I see the American people as generous, good-hearted, and they like to help. And also, you know, for the Iraqi people and the Iranian people and for the Turkish people, the people are really people, and they are really nice. And they need somebody to lead them in the best possible way in achieving peace, in achieving economic prosperity, and instead of, you know, how much you spend for a bomb, you could build 10 houses. It is the politicians And honestly, I don't understand the mentality. I mean, I know power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and that when you sit on a chair, you want to make yourself engraved in history. But it should be engraved in a nice way, not in a war. What would history would write about these people who accusing Iraq of mass destruction weapon and of having connection to Al-Qaeda and having connection to 9/11, and after that there is no truth at all in it. What would they, how do they face their sons and daughters, how they face their grandchildren? What history would write about them? They built a war on lies in order to destroy a country, and what for? What did they get? Well, look at the result.
What did they get? What are they getting out of this?
Shame. What did they get?
But they're also getting a lot of resources, aren't they? A lot of oil resources, for example.
We could have given them oil resources as much as they want. They're going to drink the oil. We would, you know, sell it, and we sold it cheap. The idea of democracy, and I know the West likes democracy, and we liked it. I wish we could have it. But it doesn't come with bombs. It doesn't come by installing somebody like Bremer in Iraq or Karzai in Afghanistan. It has to be nurtured. Instead of hitting us with bombs, they should have opened schools, a free education for democracy. They should give scholarships to Iraqis to come to the States and study and see how democracy works and see the benefit of democracy. We like that. We don't like dictators. We weren't born as dictators, but the social and political system encourages. That's the whole Middle East, not only Iraq. They singled Iraq for probably oil or for the idea that the regime was hated and disliked and things. But the whole Middle East, the ruler didn't come by election. He came by military coup d'etat or by inherited it from his father. We didn't know the alternative. It is always a closed channel. I would love to be elected to represent my district in Baghdad. I would love to represent them and serve them. But even when there was an election, what they call election during the government before the war, and there I could have run very easily, but I knew it wasn't really pure democratic. I mean, you know, they like me, they choose me or something. I refused. I wanted truly to be elected by my own people and to be truly representative of them. So we know, I mean, especially the educated, what we know that the best form of government is democracy, although there are lots of, you know, cheating and election and rigging.
Variety,
but nevertheless, it is better than the form of dictatorship. I have faith in President Obama. We are sitting in Amman and in Iraq, and you should see the joy of him being elected. And I pray to God that he will change the aggressive mentality of the Bush administration.
Well, I want to come back to President Obama, but I want to remind our listeners that we're talking with Dr. Mudhafar Al-Amin, who was the Iraqi ambassador to the UK from 1999 to 2003, which means that you were there during the build-up to this war.
Yes.
Tell our listeners how that was.
To sum it up before I go into it, it was the hardest 4 years in my life, and it cost me in health and mental peace a lot, because I was transferred from Belgium, actually. I was the charge d'affaires in Belgium, and they wanted me to go to London. And I knew the situation because I studied in London, and I know the British government and Tony Blair. He is not easy. He's a manipulator, and he was getting closer and closer to the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. So at the end, I had to go and to be the Iraqi ambassador there, which they called Iraqi Interest Section, because we didn't have relations with Britain. And I went to Baghdad and I got instructions to do my best to improve the relations with Britain and not to leave any stone unturned in achieving that goal. I was in a way lucky because I had some of my colleagues, students, in the days of a student, which I told you from 1975 to 80, and I was very active politically. So I knew lots of Arabs and Iraqis and who helped me in a way at the beginning, introduced me to politicians, parliament members, and even they wrote in the paper that Iraq is making, putting a new face and making a very strong campaign to improve relations. And I realized that the campaign, and especially after 9/11, that Iraq was targeted. I could tell you within a week, I sent a telegram to Baghdad saying that you better watch out because Iraq is targeted within the 9/11, especially when Richard Perle, after 3 days or 4 days of 9/11, he said, we have to attack Iraq. And there was talk about it. I was picking up and meeting with British politicians and members of the parliament. After that, the campaign of lies started, accusing Iraq of having relation to Al-Qaeda and the involvement of 9/11. I went to the Foreign Office and I went to the parliament. I had meeting with four important members in the parliament. And I said, definitely there is no any connection. The Ba'ath ruling party and even Saddam Hussein wasn't a religious man. He was very secular. And the Al-Qaeda and all these religious extremists, they couldn't cooperate to even talk to Iraq or have any relations. And there is no way that one single terrorism act came out of Iraq.
Not to mention the sanctions that had been going on prior to that.
Which destroyed the Iraq and the limitation and the financial which beset the country. From 1993, when I returned from Germany, until I went to Belgium, assigned to Belgium, 1988, I was receiving $4 a month as a salary. If I didn't have the savings from work at the United Nations and before in Germany, I could never survive. Then I'm a PhD, I'm a doctor, I've been nominated to be ambassador for a long time. But the country was in a dire economic grip that there is no way. And then the mentality of the Iraqis are not terrorists. Even now, we think this is not an Iraqi, the bombings and the killings, and this is imported from abroad. So, but I realized that there was a campaign of lies being built against Iraq, accusing it of everything. I had to go almost weekly, on weekly basis, briefing everybody and telling them this is not the truth. At the end, Blair issued a report accusing Iraq of having mass destruction weapon, and they could make a bomb in 40 hours, and they attack Europe and this. I had a letter from the foreign minister. I went to the foreign ministry and told them that Mr. Blair could fly with me tonight with as many inspectors as he wishes to take, British inspectors, with him, that familiar with Iraq. And we go together to every part of Iraq. Everything is open for him. If he wants to see that there is mass destruction weapon or anywhere, and if he find it, he will take it with him. It took a week for them to answer that, no, we would never go to Iraq because we don't want to give credibility. I said, what a credibility. You are accusing a country of having mass destruction weapon. Why don't you come to Iraq and inspect it? And they refused. They refused our offer, and they said, we don't want to deal with Saddam Hussein's government. Don't deal with the government. You go with me, I'm the ambassador, and I will take you. And you tell me, we take helicopters, and we would go to any place with your inspectors. And it would have been a way of solving partially the tension that was created by them. This is a very historical statement, I have to say. They knew that Iraq did not have mass destruction weapon. If they knew that Iraq have mass destruction weapon, they wouldn't have attacked Iraq. The reason they attacked Iraq, because they knew that the Iraqi army was weakened by the sanctions and by the Kuwaiti war, which was a big mistake. And they were sure that we had no mass destruction weapon of any sort. And that if we defended ourselves, we have to defend it with basic, simple weapons.
So you were one of the few Iraqis at the time who was trying to convince the English government, and then subsequently through the English government, the American government, that war against your country was not the thing to do. This must have been a tremendous stress.
Yes, beside the Guardian, I had many interviews, and you could read my article in the Times of London. And I explained to them, and I explained it to the Foreign Office, to the State Department, the British, every time I go. I said, look, I know you could attack Iraq. I know you will destroy the Iraqi army. I know you would occupy Iraq. And you have to leave within 5 years or 10 years, you will leave. But the only thing you will be written in the history, you will be not only disappointed, but you will be backfire against you, and that you will ruin the Iraqi society. And the only winner is Iran. By weakening Iraq and dividing the society on sectarian basis, you will give Iran the ultimate wish that they could expand their influence into Iraq, mm-hmm. which they couldn't before. Mm-hmm. At the end, look what happened to Britain, and you could see it in writing, and I'm sure it's in the records there, that I said Iraq will be ruined as a society, you will dismantle it with your, you would, I said, no, Saddam Hussein will go, and in 1 week, Iraq would be a flourishing country. Mm. Occupation never served the country. Foreign powers never really did good. What they say about Germany and Japan after the Second World War, it is the society, their society who made it, not General MacArthur who installed the democracy. It is the people of Japan who made the difference. It's the German people who are worked hard and in harmony, although they divided their country. It's almost like Sunni and Shia, they made East Germany and West Germany, and they're trying to fight between themselves. But the German people are so hardworking, and they had the opportunity with the Marshall Plan and with the Soviet Union being, you know, the scary crow, they had to work hard. The West had to help them. But with Iraq, actually the American occupation not only destroyed the Iraqi army, not only destroyed the Iraqi government, they destroyed the Iraqi fabrics of the society. And at the end, Britain ran away. They left Iraq with, what accomplishment did they do? Mm-hmm. Absolutely nothing. They killed little kids in the street and shooting. And look at the Americans now, claiming that they are leaving Iraq, but they are not leaving. They are deploying their forces, and they have big bases. And what Iraq? They have no electricity now with the heat, over 120, between 110 and 120, no electricity, 2 hours maximum during the day. They cannot sleep. There is no water. There is no gas. There is no Iraq used to produce oil and gas cheaper than water. Now they import it. They import it from Iran. The farmers are not planting anything. All the small factories are closed. The only possible jobs that you could get is either in the army or in the police. And that has to be on the expense that you might get killed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it bears repeating that we're not getting that story here in the United States at this point. We're getting the story that Obama is going to pull us out, the troops out.
I hope so.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Obama. He's reached out very clearly to Arabs and Arab Americans.
Yes, his speech at Cairo University was great, was welcomed by everybody.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he's not pulling the troops out.
I mean, it's not only enough to pull the troops. We don't like the occupation. I don't like to see any foreign soldier on my soil. And that's why I left Iraq. That's why I left the foreign ministry. Because there were soldiers, American soldiers, in the foreign ministry.
Well, let's come around now. Tell that part of the story. The part why you left.
Okay. So the as far as Iraq, not only they leave, the American soldiers, they leave. They have to rebuild Iraq. They have to pay for the damages that done to every building, to every house, to every family. You know, at least 1.5 million Iraqis killed since 2003. Who is responsible for them? Who? This is the Bush administration responsibility for every single Iraqi, innocent Iraqi killed, regardless of the soldiers and the fighting, which lasted only 3 weeks. But after that, thousands and thousands and thousands of people, innocent people, got killed. Look at the Abu Ghraib and the rest. That's in every prison. This awful incident took place. They treated us like dirt. This is not the way to liberate a country. And then the physical and the human and the mental damage they have to do. And they have to put a line that Iran would not interfere into Iraqi affairs. They allowed Iran, they opened the borders, and they let Iran get involved in every sector of the government and in every layer of the society. They have to give us back Iraq, an independent, well-built country. Then they erase their responsibility in history.
Well, what about the ongoing split between the Sunni and Shia that has been promoted?
Promoted, it's been implanted, actually. You know, Iraq, for years, there is Sunni, Shi'i, Kurds, Christians, Yazidis. It's Mesopotamia. It's a mosaic of nationalities. I come from Mosul, and in Mosul there is interactions between different nationalities, between Iraqis, of Kurdish stock, from Arabic stock, from Turkish stock. But the feeling that we have, we grow up within our compound, is Arabic, and we claim to be an Arab. But you ask me if I'm 100% Arab, I tell you no, I'm not sure. And this is better for the Arab world. I mean, you know, we could have a stronger country anyway. Sunni and Shi'i has been there for about 1400 years. Each one has his own very particular ways, not much difference. And basically, to start with, Iraq was a secular society. The religious people are confined to small cities and mosques. They did not have outreach to the society. Then the American occupation and Bremer, the civil ruler who came, the king of Iraq, they call him, and read his book. He came with the idea of dividing the Iraqi society on three sections. Number one, The Sunnis minority, as if he has taken, census in Iraq, but he claimed that this is the Sunnis are the minority who are ruled Iraq from 1921 until 2003 when overruled by Saddam. And this minority had supported Saddam totally and against the Shia minority who were deprived and had nothing to do with the government and they were persecuted. These two sections. So the Sunnis were the minority Sunnis were against the majority Shiite. Then now the majority Shiite should persecute the minority Sunni. It's a war. He declared war. At the same time that the Kurds who composed, somehow he gave them between 20 to 25%, which according to our knowledge and our census before, about 15%, regardless. But also they were persecuted by the Sunni Arabs, and they should take their revenge. He put the society on war against each other. The Sunnis, he kept saying, you read his book, to the Shiite, and who is not the Shiite people, it's not the Iraqi population. They brought them from England, from the United States, and from Iran, from Syria. They were immigrants. They had left the country for political reasons or any reason. He brought them with them. He made them leaders. He kept telling them, don't make the mistakes of the Shiites in 1921 when Iraq formed the government and they refused to participate. Don't make the mistake again. You participate by power. He gave them, out of 25, the what they call Majlis al-Hukum, the ruling council that was selected by Bremer, he gave the Shiites 17 seats, he gave the Kurds 5, and he gave the Sunnis only 3. And that created real antagonism even, I mean, this is not the way we dealt. He dismissed the army, and he brought people that is small people from outside the army and gave them big ranks. Actually, the army was a mixture of everybody. Kurds, Arabs, Sunni, Shiite. We don't have that. Hmm. And the same thing with the government. According to the Americans had printed 55 on cards. According to our information, 34 of them are Shiites out of the 55. According to our information, the members of the Ba'ath Party, 62% were Shiite. Actually, in history, the first Ba'ath command of the party, which is established in Karbala in 1950-51, were all Shiite. The first general secretary of the party, Fuad al-Rikabi, was a Shiite. I keep telling my people not to be pushed by this secretarian. When they ask me if you are a Sunni or Shia, I said, I'm not. I don't answer and I don't care. It's enough I'm a Muslim. I was born Muslim and I remain to be Muslim. If I was born a Christian, I would have remained to be Christian. If I was a Yazidi, I would have still Yazidi. And this does not make any difference between me.
But it has taken hold in Iraq at this point, hasn't it?
This is a government policy. When you bring all your relatives and your friends and things, and put them in the government, the other sectors would feel deprived. Then you create a problem. Somebody says, I'm the leader of the Sunnis. You ask the vice president, who is supposed to be Tariq al-Hashimi, ask him who elected him from the Sunnis. Nobody knew him. The factor in Iraq was and should be that either you are a nationalist Iraqi that you seek the betterment of your country, or you are working with the occupiers. You are cooperating as an agent. There are lots of great Iraqis who are Kurds. I told you about my ambassador, Esmet Kitani. He was a Kurd from Sulaymaniyah. He is the most respected diplomat in the history of Iraq. I worked with him. I didn't tell him, no, I don't listen to you because you're a Kurd. I respected him, and he's a brother, and he died, and I still remember him every day.
Under what conditions would you return to Iraq? Now, you were last there in...
After the occupation, I was called by the Bremer administration on the 2nd of June 2003. They called all the Iraqi ambassadors. We were 29 ambassadors who came to Baghdad. 11 didn't show up. So outside was 40 ambassadors. And they made interview with each one for about an hour. And I was on the second day. And he interviewed me about my background, my education.
Bremer?
No, Ambassador Denver, a retired ambassador who was a friend of Bremer, who brought him, and he was responsible for the foreign ministry. He interviewed me with four Iraqi who cooperated with the occupation, who were ambassadors, and asked me about my education, and asked me about my party affiliation, and I told them the truth. And asked me about the embassy in London, what it has, the housing and cars and financial, which I brought the money. And he said that they had decided to keep me as ambassador, to continue. And then they would decide where they send me. And I said, no, thank you, I don't want to work. He was surprised, and they were surprised because, you know, they gave me, clear me out and give me clearance, and I'm a nice guy. And I really, it was final for me. Like I said, especially when I saw the soldiers in the foreign ministry. There's no way a foreign soldier comes and pull my ear, tell me you're not a good ambassador.
Under what circumstances would you go back?
Number one, I don't get killed. Number two, it's a national government, that the government serves the Iraq and the Iraqi people. I will go back not as ambassador, but as a junior diplomat, or even I'm ready to clean the garden or anything in my country. I have no specific things, anything. I teach in elementary school. I teach in kindergarten. I just want to go back.
Dr. Mudafar Al-Amin, I know that you are thirsty because of Ramadan.
Yes.
I appreciate you spending this hour with us, but I want to give you the opportunity to speak directly to Americans. Is there something that you would like them to know particularly?
Well, I really want them to know that there is a great damage done to my country, and it should be corrected one way or the other. I've been here for 2 months, and I have noticed that Iraq has disappeared from the television and from the newspapers and the media. Iraq is suffering, and there should be a remedy by the Obama government, by the Obama administration. It shouldn't be just a matter of having troops or moving troops. This country is wounded. It's not wounded, it's in intensive care, and it should be treated. The American people are generous, they are good, and that mistake should be corrected by them. They should write to their congressmen, they should do something to force the government and the defense establishment to do something in Iraq to revive the economy, to rebuild the country. There were so billions were stolen during the first 45 years of the Bush administration. Billions. It went to you know, somewhere, God knows. And this country should not be forgotten. It should be on their conscience.
I think it's one of the crimes of, well, certainly of my lifetime, is to see what's happened there and to be complicit in what happens has happened there. It's a shameful thing.
It's a big crime. It is definitely, I think, sooner or later it would go to the International Court of Justice. There is no ground whatsoever for hitting Iraq with one bomb. If they were against Saddam Hussein, they could have assassinated him very easily. But they wanted to ruin Iraq. They wanted to ruin the Iraqi society.
That was Dr. Muhtafar Al-Amin, former ambassador from Iraq, interviewed in San Jose, California, on September 11, 2009. Dr. Amin and I mentioned the International Criminal Court in our segment. For those unaware of it, this independent permanent court is located in The Hague in the Netherlands, although it may also sit elsewhere. It is not part of the United Nations, but it maintains a cooperative relationship with the United Nations. The ICC, International Criminal Court, is based on a treaty, the Rome Statute, and joined by 110 countries. The United States is currently not one of these 110 countries, although Britain is. President Clinton signed onto the treaty, and President George W. Bush rescinded Clinton's signing. By the end of his term, however, Bush was sounding more accepting of the court, especially after his own conclusions that, quote-unquote, genocide was occurring in Darfur. That warming trend has continued under the Obama team, with some court supporters expecting the administration to move toward joining the ICC. The ICC is a court of last resort that tries persons accused of the most serious crimes of international concern, namely genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. It will not act if a case is investigated or prosecuted by a national judicial system unless the national proceedings are not genuine. For example, if formal proceedings were undertaken solely to shield a person from criminal responsibility. In addition, the ICC only tries those accused of the gravest crimes. In all of its activities, the ICC observes the highest standards of fairness and due process. The jurisdiction and functioning of the ICC are governed, as I mentioned, by the Rome Statute. This was done at Rome on the 17th day of July, 1998. The statute is 88 pages, describing 123 articles, so far too long to discuss in any detail here, and I'll put a link to the Rome Statute on the Raising Sand Radio website and urge you to take a look at it. It has not been smooth sailing for the ICC, and it faces stiff challenges in the coming years. Supporters of the court who gathered in New York this week, including its chief prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, say second thoughts by some countries that signed on to the court are just part of the challenge. These include criticisms that the ICC only goes after rights violators in weak countries. For example, resistance to the court has been brewing in these regions of Africa that initially supported it. The African Union recently said it would not honor the arrest warrant for Sudan's president, Omar al-Bashir, over alleged war crimes committed in the country's Darfur region. Moreover, controversy surrounding the court could build if some preliminary inquiries into alleged war crimes in Afghanistan, committed by both NATO troops and Taliban forces, are pushed further. Ocampo notes that Afghanistan is an ICC signatory, so the court has quote-unquote normal jurisdiction there. Right now, he says the court is simply assessing cases of quote-unquote collateral damage and alleged torture to see whether they warrant a full investigation. The implication of such an inquiry, that NATO and American forces might be charged with a crime by the ICC, is what led the Bush administration to rescind President Clinton's signing of the Rome Statute. Christian Wennerwisser, Liechtenstein's UN representative and president of the ICC's Assembly of States Parties, says, quote, "The goal of the ICC is not to put on trial everybody who violates the Rome Statute. The goal is to end impunity." One can only hope that the circumstances surrounding the 2003 invasion occupation of Iraq are one day examined by the ICC. And that's our show for today. Views expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. If you have any comments or questions, please feel free to email me at susan@raisingsandradio.com and join us again next week. We will be talking with Dr. Michael Parenti on the interesting topics of assimilation and acculturation. And we'll go out with, again, Axiom of Choice and the Chaos Paradise.